Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and thank you for joining me on this edition of the English program. I'm Linda Bordoni. Today we begin with Jill Bevilacqua's weekly reflection, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye, with readings by Sean Patrick Lovett.
After the crowds had their fill, Jesus insisted that his disciples get into the boat and precede him to the other side. When he'd sent them away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray, remaining there alone as evening drew on. Meanwhile, the boat, already several hundred yards out from shore, was being tossed about in the waves raised by strong headwinds. At about 3 a.m, he came walking toward them on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the water, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and in their fear they began to cry out. Jesus hastened to reassure them. "Get hold of yourselves, it is I. Do not be afraid." Peter spoke up and said, "Lord, if it is really you, tell me to come to you across the water." "Come," he said. So Peter got out of the boat and began to walk on the water, moving toward Jesus. But when he perceived how strong the wind was, becoming frightened, he began to sink and cried out, "Lord, save me!" Jesus at once stretched out his hand and caught him. "How little faith you have," he exclaimed. "Why did you falter?" Once they had climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Those who were in the boat showed him reverence, declaring, "Beyond doubt, you are the Son of God."
The Gospel for today opens in our version with a phrase shown in brackets, which serves as an introduction. But why is it followed then by Jesus insisting that the disciples get into the boat and precede him to the other side? We find the explanation in St. John's Gospel, after his account of the miracle of the feeding of the 5,000.
The people, seeing this sign that he had given, said, "This really is the prophet who is come into the world." Jesus, who could see they were about to come and take him by force and make him king, escaped back to the hills by himself.
A scholar comments that although the miraculous sign has what seems at first a positive effect, this is received by Jesus with reserve. In fact, of itself, the acclamation of him as prophet and king would be a recognition of his messianic reality.
But the crowd's declaration is made in a nationalistic and socio-political perspective, which Jesus does not accept. This is why he withdraws away from the enthusiasm of the people.
Writes another.
Mark also lets it be understood that this was a critical moment. Jesus sent the disciples away, trying to escape from the crowd, and then prayed. And immediately he obliged his disciples to go up into the ship, that they might go before him over the water to Bethsaida, whilst he dismissed the people. And when he had dismissed them, he went up to the mountain to pray.
There's something of an anomaly in this account of Mark's. We know that Jesus and the disciples are already on the side of the lake near Bethsaida. And in fact, John, who was certainly there, writes,
"That evening the disciples went down to the shore of the lake and got into a boat to make for Capernaum on the other side of the lake."
Was Peter somewhat confused when he recounted this episode to Mark? It was certainly a dramatic episode, and Peter himself plays a leading part in it. But Mark does not recount this, for Peter, in his humility, does not wish to draw the attention to himself. But let's pick up where we left off. Jesus has managed to get rid of the crowds and has returned up the hill to pray. One feels he must have desperately needed the contact with his Father at this moment. No one else can do. Meanwhile, the disciples are struggling to make some headway across the lake. But the wind is against them, and by about 3 in the morning they have still made only 3 or 4 miles. 25 or 30 furlongs, writes John. In our gospel today we heard of several hundred yards out from shore, tossed about in the waves raised by strong headwinds. For although the fishing boat had sails, they were unable to hoist them because of the contrary wind, and had to depend on their oars. From his hilltop, Jesus saw that they were battling with a heavy sea, and Mark writes,
"He could see they were worn out with rowing, and about the 4th watch of the night he came towards them, walking on the lake."
Both Matthew and Mark use the phrase, "the 4th watch," which for us is translated as "about 3 in the morning." The Hebrews divided the night into 4 watches. The first was at dusk, the second at midnight, sometimes referred to as the middle watch. The third was when the cock crows, or simply at cock crow. The 4th, at early dawn or dawning, referred here as the morning watch. And immediately the words of the De Profundis, the 129th psalm, come to mind.
From the morning watch even until night, let Israel hope in the Lord.
Or, as the more modern version has it,
my soul is longing for the Lord, more than watchmen for daybreak. Let the watchman count on daybreak, and Israel on the Lord.
The watchman was an essential figure always, and is mentioned in yet another psalm.
If the Lord does not watch over the city, in vain does the watchman keep vigil.
And so, in the 4th watch of the night, he went towards them, walking on the lake. And Mark, who is writing for Peter, inserts this phrase, "He was going to pass them by." What does this mean exactly? Peter is remembering that night, and perhaps that was the impression he had. And after all, we have to remember that when the disciples saw Jesus in the distance, they were terrified. If someone was walking on the water, it could only be a ghost. And this is what they cry out. In their fear, as Matthew writes, and fear works on the imagination. But Jesus doesn't leave them in that terrified state. He hastened to reassure them. "Courage, it is I. Do not be afraid." What happened next? Of the 3 evangelists who recount this episode, only Matthew adds the incident of Peter walking on the water. After quoting our Lord's words of encouragement, Mark writes simply,
"Then he got into the boat with them, and the wind dropped. They were utterly and completely dumbfounded, because they had not seen what the miracle of the loaves meant. Their minds were closed."
And a scholar comments,
"Jesus dominates the dark forces of chaos and of evil with his omnipotent control, which, however, is hidden from the eyes of the disciples, who are disturbed but whose hearts are hardened."
Perhaps the Jerusalem Bible version, "their minds were closed," renders the idea better. And another scholar writes,
"Mark stresses the contrast between the sovereign power of Jesus and the fear of the disciples, who had not realized that it was Jesus."
In John's account, the words of Jesus are followed by this statement,
"They were for taking him into the boat, but in no time it reached the shore, at the place they were making for."
And commenting on this, our scholar writes,
"At the centre of this manifestation of Jesus as Lord of being and of nothingness, the waters are the symbol of chaos, conquered by God in the creation, there is the solemn declaration, 'It is I,' which recalls the revelation of the divine name to Moses on Sinai in the burning bush, 'I am who I am.' There is also a repetition of the symbol of the sea crossed by Israel in the liberating Exodus and a reference to Psalm 77. 'You strode across the sea, you marched across the ocean, but your steps could not be seen.' So we are shown the divine dimension of Jesus and his ability to be present among us by another way than that which is purely physical and material."
and so to the extraordinary moment which Matthew presents when, as Sheed puts it,
Peter emerges from the anonymity of the group for the first time since the apostles were chosen. Till this moment, there had been nothing in the 9 months since then to single him out from the rest.
Matthew, who was present in the boat, tells us clearly that Peter spoke up. In another version,
it was Peter who answered, "Lord, if it is you, tell me to come to you across the water." And Jesus said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and began to walk on the water.
And Piero Bargellini interprets the scene.
In that gesture, in those words, there is the whole of Peter, all the impulsiveness and at the same time the weakness of the Galilean fisherman, which make of him such a sincere, such a human figure, different from all the others. Simon Peter was a seaman, so he feared the treachery of the waves and the inconsistency of the winds. And yet, while the others trembled, he had the courage to entrust himself to a test which is inconceivable for a sailor. The sailor fights to the last inside his nutshell. His world is not the sea, it's the boat. Beyond the confines of the boat is the water, the dominion of the wave, over which he has no power. The ablest of seamen in the handling of the boat is never so presumptuous as to think he can control the sea. We have to think of this in order to understand how great was the faith of that man who lived his life on the restless waves and who asks Jesus, "Tell me to come to you across the water." Only by forgetting himself and the whole of his experience was he able to say this. And then the act of climbing out of the boat to walk on the water was simply madness beyond the imagination of any sailor. At that moment, Peter is outside any norm of prudence. He's beside himself. He doesn't consider whether it's advisable, appropriate, or safe. He only obeys the command of Jesus. And in doing this, he once more stands out distinctly from all the others. Paradoxically, in him, the future head of the church is proclaimed. His action, inexplicable in human terms, explains better than any other in the history of the church the conduct of his successors, which considerations of prudence, of wisdom, of diplomacy, of astuteness never fully explain. At a certain point, there's always that stepping outside the boat. In other words, the act which is beyond human justification and is only obedience to the Lord's command.
And so Peter steps out of the boat and begins to walk on the water. But then he looks down and sees the blackness of the waves and feels the violence of the wind. And as Bargellini comments,
bit by bit, the anxieties of the sailor got the better of the faith of the apostle. He began to feel his feet, his ankles, his knees entangled by the water. He was sinking.
And a few lines from a man who died in 1900 and who remains, I quote, a controversial figure as misunderstood today as he was in his own day. Oscar Wilde. His poem, E Tenebris, opens like this.
Come down, O Christ, and help me. Reach thy hand, for I am drowning in a stormier sea than Simon on thy lake of Galilee.
Wilde's Heart of Stone, runs the comment on this poem, was broken in Reading Jail, and although doubts persisted right until the very end, he was finally received into the Catholic Church on his deathbed.
My heart is as some famine-murdered land, when all good things have perished utterly, and well I know my soul in hell must lie, if I this night before God's throne should stand. Nay, peace I shall behold before the night, the feet of brass, the robe more white than flame, the wounded hands, the weary human face.
Peter, in his fear and humanity, beginning to sink, had no doubts as to who could help him, and to whom he cried out, "Lord, help me." And Bargellini concludes.
The reproof of Jesus, "Why did you doubt, O man of little faith?" is not an accusation of weak faith. It's an observation, a statement of the fact of human weakness, and emphasizes the act of great faith, when Peter, and only he, entrusted himself to God, like one who is absent-minded, abandoning the boat and separating himself, not only materially from all his companions, who stayed as they were, holding on to the bulkheads and shrouds of the boat.
And let's close with the celebrated hymn for those in peril on the sea. Eternal Father, strong to save, whose arm doth bind the restless wave, who bids the mighty ocean deep its own appointed limits keep, O hear us when we cry to thee for those in peril on the sea.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua, who wrote and presented There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Turning to something quite different, a few weeks before leaving Rome for his annual summer travels to pursue his work for Interreligious Dialogue, my friend Benedictine Abbot Timothy Wright regaled me with an interesting story. It's about an ancient wooden panel taken by a soldier from the Abbey of Monte Cassino in 1944, and this year returned to where it came from by the Dean of Westminster Abbey in London.
As a Benedictine monk, of course, I follow matters Benedictine quite closely and as far as possible from Rome. And carrying this title of the titular abbot of Westminster Abbey in London, of course, gives me a nice alternative ancient Benedictine community, now of course an Anglican church and centre of so many wonderful things in the liturgies and ceremonies of Britain and the United Kingdom. Monte Cassino, the place which Haya persuaded Benedict from his cave in Subiaco to be their superior, and was where he wrote the rule around about 500 AD, or compiled the rule more accurately, was also badly destroyed, as many of you will know, in 1944 by the Allies during their advance through Italy. It being a very strategic place with a very good view over the surrounding countryside. So in that destruction, it was agreed that the Americans, who actually bombed it, would repay by rebuilding it, and that is the Monte Cassino we have today, the massive, wonderful monastery on the top of that hill overlooking the plains below, right over to the sea. Over a number of occasions in recent years, the Archabbot of Monte Cassino has undertaken an initiative to have a sort of pilgrimage of peace, to recall the destruction of Monte Cassino, to put aside any sense of guilt and grievance arising from it, and more positively, a determination to heal wounds and to promote peace, not just in Europe, but throughout the world. And one of the ways he does this is by organising a group from Cassino, the town of Cassino, and some of the monks, to visit another city, obviously mainly in Europe, where they will go to the cathedral or to the monastery and they'll have a candle lit, a little ceremony, and then that candle is solemnly brought back to Monte Cassino around about the time of the Feast of St. Benedict on the 21st of March. This year, the chosen place to visit was Westminster Abbey in London. And I was privileged, of course, as the titular abbot, to be invited to take part by the Dean John Hall, and one or two of the canons who were present there, Jane Hedges, wonderful woman canon, the first woman canon of Westminster Abbey, ordained priest in the Anglican Church. And she was there, and various other of the junior canons as well as the choir. And we had a evensong with bishops from the Anglican Church and bishops from Italy, particularly the Bishop of Norcia, and, as I say, several monks and people from Cassino, and a congregation of perhaps 300 or 400 people in the abbey to celebrate this prayer for peace within the context of their evening liturgy, evensong. And it was a wonderful moment at the end when the dean with the abbot, they lit the candle and a procession out to take the candle eventually back to Monte Cassino. And that was the start of a little pilgrimage. Probably about 2 weeks later, we arrive at the 20th of March and I'm invited down to Monte Cassino itself, to the abbey, to see the reception of the lighted candle and to continue the prayer for peace throughout the world. And in those ceremonies, we had a Vespers on the evening of the 20th of March, to which Canon John Hall was present with one of his junior canons and myself, and various other local guests, and they provided a wonderful little ceremony of Vespers and special prayer, special readings, homilies to mark the occasion, followed by a nice concert in the abbey, then a festive meal, and then a mass the following morning to celebrate the big feast of Saint Benedict. Now, during the course of all that, there was one little story which moved many of us there almost to tears. The story goes like this, that Canon John Hall brought to Monte Cassino, covered in bright red cloth, a plaque, a wooden plaque, with an engraving of the, I think it was of the Nativity. And the story is that after the Battle of Monte Cassino, one of the Allied soldiers, who was presumably walking around the ruins of the abbey, found this plaque lying down and picked it up. Clearly, it was obviously just a bit of wood lying on the ground. There was nothing to... It wasn't painted, it was just probably oak, about half a metre long and a few centimetres wide and fairly thin, so it was quite easy to carry. So he took it off and thought that would be a nice souvenir for him. Story is, I think, that he later got injured, and the nurse, who was not a Catholic, cared for him, and as a sign of his thanks, he gave her the plaque. So the plaque went back to England, and time passed from 1944, and during that time this nurse had looked after numerous different people at different stages of their lives, etc., etc. And at one stage, one of the people who was looked after by her was the former British ambassador to the Holy See, Francis Campbell. When she came to die, or was dying, and wanted to dispose of her effects, she thought, well, who can I give this to? And obviously Francis had touched her in some way, and they'd been friends, and so she passed from her Protestant position, Anglican Protestant position possibly, to the Catholic Francis Campbell, the plaque, which was part of the previous monastery at Monte Cassino. So with that, later on, he comes to hear of this initiative by the Archabbot of Monte Cassino to light his candle in Westminster Abbey. And so, thinking that this might be a nice gesture, he passes from the Catholic former ambassador to the Holy See, British ambassador to the Holy See, to the Anglican dean of Westminster Abbey, this plaque, saying that since Westminster Abbey as part of the Pilgrimage of Peace linked to Monte Cassino this year, why not offer this back as a gift? And so, at the end of one of the ceremonies in Monte Cassino, Dean John Hall, with his brilliantly red cover, presented this to the Archabbot, this plaque from the old Monte Cassino. So in a lovely sort of way, everything had come full circle. The prayer for peace had brought always the intentions of where there is fighting and war going on. And behind the prayer for peace are the small little undergrowths of new life, of reconciliation, of return and rediscovery. And within that context, the plaque, the return of the plaque to the abbey at Monte Cassino was something that touched a lot of people, coming as it did from Britain, who were, at least were involved in the fighting at the Battle of Monte Cassino itself. And significantly enough, one of the monks in my own community at Ampleforth, Father George Forbes, he was a chaplain to some of the British forces there in Monte Cassino, and for his courageous prayer to encourage the soldiers was awarded the Military Cross, which is a decoration for bravery. And it's a nice way that these little threads link in with each other, and that our lives are never just one thing, but there are always other stories behind, and these other stories reveal to us that human interest and human feelings and human suffering and human pain and human joy are all interlinked in some way in our lives. And an event like the Pilgrimage of Peace and the restoration of this panel to its original owner just enriches the experience, and a wonderful experience it was too.
That's all from the English feature programme today, but we'll be back at this same time tomorrow, so join us then. You can also listen to our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. You're listening to Vatican Radio's English programme. Laudetur Jesus Christus.